Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to tonight's program at the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Carolyn Wang Kong, Senior Program Officer at Blue Shield of California Foundation, which helps support this program tonight. I'd like to personally welcome our live audience who are here in the club's beautiful new building at 110 Embarcadero in San Francisco. And I'd also like to welcome our audiences who are listening via radio and also online. I invite everyone to check out the clubs online at commonwealthclub.org, where you can check out all of the upcoming events at the club, as well as listen to thousands of podcasts of previous programs. It's my great pleasure this evening to introduce our speaker, Manuel Pastor. Manuel is a professor of sociology as well as American studies and ethnicity at the University of Southern California, where he also holds the Terpangian Chair for Civil Society and Social Change. It's a mouthful. His latest book, which we will be discussing tonight, right here, is State of Resistance, What California's Dizzying Descent and Remarkable Resurgence Mean for America's Future. As Californians, we really pride ourselves on our state's reputation for being forward-thinking and inclusive. We are a big and diverse state, and we don't shy away from speaking up, particularly in defense of our shared values. But for many of us, the past few years have tested that notion. Newly exposed, deep-seated divisions have surfaced, often bitter divisions. Our politics have grown more and more polarized every day, fueling our fears and anxieties. And federal policies have unleashed relentless attacks on our values, values that define the character of our state. So what can our past teach us about California's role in this context? How do we balance resistance against progress? And does this idea of California really stand up in light of the injustices and inequities that are faced by so many of the California communities that we see every day? At the Foundation, it's our mission to improve the lives of all Californians. In this moment, that's meant adapting our approach to build on the progress that we've made while also remaining inflexible in defense of our values. That's why we're so excited to be supporting tonight's program, so Manuel can help us answer these tough questions. But in all seriousness, we really cannot imagine a more fitting speaker to lead us through this discussion tonight, to really help us understand the lessons from California's past that can help us not only move our state forward, but also our country forward. I would like to now introduce Autumn McDonald, who will be interviewing Manuel this evening. Autumn is the executive director of New America California, which also helped to support tonight's program. Autumn.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much to the Commonwealth Club, to Blue Shield of California Foundation, and to all of you for being here this evening, as well as anyone who is listening at home. That introduction told us a little bit about your work. It told us a little bit about what you've been engaged in your day job. And I would love if you would start us off by telling us a little bit about the story of you. If you would give us 3 minutes on the story of you that's beyond both the intro and what one might hear in the book.
Yeah, that's my next book. It's all about me. So very, very excited to be writing that one. I guess a couple of things. One is I'm typical of a lot of Californians in that I was not born here. I was born actually in Brooklyn, New York. My parents moved here in the 1950s. This is a true story because my sister had asthma, and the doctors told them that they moved to Los Angeles, that would be good for her asthma. This was the era in which doctors were saying that filtered cigarettes would toughen you up for the future. So that's how we made it to California. My dad was an immigrant. He came to the United States in the 1930s with papers that were imperfect. And when World War II came along, he was given a choice between being deported or joining the U.S. Army to go fight in Europe. Another true story, he couldn't figure out what to do, so he gave a penny to my cousin Carlitos, who flipped it. And the decision was for him to go to the war, and both he and the penny came back safe. And a generation later, his son is a full professor with an endowed chair, no less, at the University of Southern California. And what I like to tell people a little bit about that story is that that's a great story, right? It's an American story, a California story. And part of what this book is about is that when you tell the story that way, it's the wrong story. Because what it misses is that my dad in the 1930s had no papers, but he had a union that defended his rights at work. And when he came back from World War II, which gave him a path to citizenship, he had a GI Bill. And that GI Bill meant that my dad, a guy with a sixth grade education, could go to LA Trade Tech, a community college, and learn about electricity. And with that, he could go from being a janitor to being an air conditioner repairman, and the family could go from being poor to being working class. And with that GI Bill, he was able to buy a home in a inner ring suburb, La Puente, just east of East LA, and get his little piece, he and my mom, of the American dream. And we were able to go to public schools that were decent because we were investing in them in that era. And when the time came for me to go to college, I went to UC Santa Cruz, by the way, fighting banana slugs. That when it came time for me to go to college, there was affirmative action to take a chance on a kid like me that did not fit the typical profile at that time of who went to the university. And that's the American story. It's the California story. It is about individuals and what they do to make their lives and dreams come true, but it's about the public policies that put in the platforms for success. And importantly, and that's an important part of the story, it's about the social movements that put those public policies there. The labor movement that brought us unions, the veterans movement that brought us the GI Bill, the civil rights movement that brought us affirmative action and broke down the racial segregation in housing that meant we could move to a suburb. So that sort of story of individuals, of policies, of social movements, that's what this book is about too. And isn't that cool how I moved from the story of me to the story of the book?
A fantastic segue. That was brilliantly executed. It's interesting because hearing you talk about the story of you is like full of passion and full of vigor, and also hearing that connection between the story of you and the story of this book. I would love to back us up, though, just for a moment to think about, because when I first thought about, I wonder why he wrote this book, I imagined that it was, you're an academic, and academics typically write books. You've written several books. Will you tell us a little bit about what makes you decide to write on a given topic, and specifically why you wrote this book? Although there was obviously a lot of that we could feel.
Well, when I choose to write, it's usually because I feel compelled by a social problem and inspired by a social movement. I see that there's an issue out there, and I see people trying to do something about it, and I find it compelling to try to write. You know what inspired this book? You know, it's pretty easy when you think of this book right now to think it was probably triggered by an election, right? And you're right. But it was not triggered by the election, you think. It was actually triggered by the Obama election. Because what I noticed in 2008 was that after Barack Obama won, a lot of progressives who wanted to make change sort of bum-rushed Washington, thinking that if they went to D.C., they could make policy change happen there. when what they really should have done was go back to communities to do the kind of organizing and mobilization that would have provided wind to Obama's sails when he was right and would have held him accountable when he was wrong. For example, when he launched the sort of largest deportation machine and regime that had existed in contemporary U.S. history. And I was kind of convinced that into that vacuum had stepped the Tea Party, which certainly was astroturfed in by the Koch brothers and their millions, but it actually also reflected a sort of legitimate sort of rage and dislocation there, and it got tapped into. And I was convinced that Hillary, like everybody else, that Hillary Clinton was going to win, and that as a result, progressives would make exactly the same mistake of forgetting about organizing. And, you know, it's important to note that in the 8 years of the Obama presidency, about 900 state assembly and state Senate seats changed hands from Democratic hands to Republican hands. Not a clear signal of necessarily moving from progressive to conservative, but somewhat associated. And so I really wrote, started writing the book, actually. We really sat down to write it in July of 2016, thinking that we would provide a sort of warning signal about the need to have a 50-state strategy about building progressive infrastructure to change all sorts of states. And then, of course, November 2016 happened. Probably like most of you, I woke up the next morning with a tremendous hangover and also with a sense of deja vu. I walked into my staff the next morning, a younger staff, and they were sort of in shock. And they sort of asked me, for a little few words of hope and inspiration. And what I said was, I think it's going to be worse than you think, which I think has turned out to be true. I said this is going to be even worse than the dark era of our Lord Reagan in the early 1980s, and I think it's turned out to be just that. But what I realized was that while there were many things that people could and should do, go to demonstrations, talk to their neighbors, mobilize communities, that one thing I could do was write a book. And to take what we were trying to do, which was this kind of lesson about the need to build progressive state infrastructure and what you could learn from the California experience doing that, and turn it to what was going on in the United States. Because in many ways, the Trump election was America's Prop 187 moment. Prop 187 was the famous proposition that passed strongly, overwhelmingly in California in 1994, in which California voters voted to deny to undocumented immigrants all sorts of social services, including education, to undocumented children. And that's the most kind of immediate parallel. But what people forget is that in the early 1990s, California suffered half of the country's net job losses as a result of the national recession. That was a recession driven by a reduction in Cold War spending, hit aerospace quite hard, toppled really the rest of the industrial infrastructure in California. And people often also forget that Rush Limbaugh began his talk radio career in Sacramento in the late 1980s. So this kind of perfect stew of demographic anxiety, economic uncertainty, and profiteering from political polarization. We did it first in California. But, 20 so years later, it's a state that it was one of the first two to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. It's a state which essentially declared itself to be a sanctuary state by codifying its decision to not cooperate with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, moving dramatically ahead on dealing with climate change, even as the federal administration is engaged in climate denial, and kind of telling the story of how all of that happened seemed to be an important thing to do that might provide some lessons for really what people need to do nationally in terms of community organizing and social movement mobilization.
So it's interesting as you talk about, everybody started migrating and going, saying, we're going to go to D.C. and we're going to make change in D.C. And then you talk about how there was really an opportunity, potentially a missed opportunity, to think about what was happening locally and at the state level and to kind of get involved there. In the book, you mention a lot of propositions. I actually at one point look at the end and look at like every single proposition and try to think if I can kind of keep them all, you know, together in my head. I would love if you would talk a little bit about them kind of like not singly, but like as in a jumble, and what you think they represent in terms of what we should be doing. And so the question I think is this, is the next step for us to think about, you know, where do we stand in terms of legislation and kind of trying to pass those that are favorable and, you know, stop or prevent those that are not favorable? What are some of your thoughts about where we should stand in terms of kind of those that are next, if you will?
Well, you know, one of the things we do in the book is talk about, we borrow a term from a political scientist named Daniel Hosang, who calls the era of the 1990s the era of racial propositions, because they were denying undocumented immigrants access to social services, eliminating bilingual education, getting rid of affirmative action, passing three strikes laws, which were clearly aimed at over-incarceration of particularly Black and Latino young men. They were, and also trying juveniles as adults, which was in the era in which super predators were perceived as being young men of color. So these were clearly had significant racial overtones to them. Yeah. You know, there was a period of mobilization. And I think, but mobilization of people who were really scared of the demographic changes that were occurring in California at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting, between 1980 and 2000, California passed from being about 67% non-Hispanic white to about 47% non-Hispanic white. That's exactly the demographic change that the U.S. is going through between the year 2000 and 2050. California was really America fast forward. And so there's all these propositions that occur in this period of time. And I think that what happened was, it's kind of interesting. It was a sort of many different factors that I think led to a sort of reconfiguration of progressive forces who got kind of tired of being beaten at the ballot box. You know, the left, you may be part of it, you may not, but I think you would agree that the left is often quite proud of itself when it loses with grace and glory, right? You know, like, we led the good fight and we got defeated, but we were so proud of the stance that we took. You know, and after a while, that gets pretty tiring. Not even if you're not just an activist, but if you're really concerned about community, you have to actually figure out how to win. And I think one of the big changes that happened, and we think it has two kind of sources. The first source is this era of racial propositions and sort of losing an era. The second, and I think it's quite significant, was the 1992 civil unrest in Los Angeles. Because one of the things about that was, you know, it was pretty easy, and I lived in L.A. at the time, to think that this should be blamed on a conservative federal government and its neglect of cities, or a way in which sort of neoliberal economics wasn't paying attention to poor communities of color. And that's all true. But if you have a city that's pissed off enough to burn itself down and you have not been able to channel that into progressive social change, there's something wrong with you too. So there was real reexamination by progressive forces, community organizers in Los Angeles, who said, we have to figure out how to bring communities together rather than have them be divided, how to operate at a regional level, and how to actually channel that rage into something more productive. Mm-hmm. And it's significant that out of LA came the living wage campaigns that eventually led to the increase in the minimum wage, came the campaigns, you know, very effective campaigns around environmental justice, which eventually helped to put environmental justice on the state policy agenda, came the campaigns to get the local police forces to not prosecute and persecute immigrants simply for violations of immigration status. And so those two threads of statewide being not wanting to lose elections anymore and beginning to realize that it was important to sort of stage modest wins at a local level, like community benefits agreements. Those things really began to change, I think, progressive politics and reconfigured it in important ways.
Yeah. It's interesting because you talked about some of the different things that have kind of moved, if you campaigns, if you will, or kind of movements or ways people have kind of started thinking a little differently about things that they were thinking about in a way earlier that was maybe not as progressive or not as activated, if you will. And so I'm curious, as you think about some of the things that are happening right now. And so, for example, when you think about kind of violence against women and girls and you think about the Me Too movement, what do you think are the opportunities for us to kind of reflect on what the possibilities are, or how could we lead in California in some way related to that issue and an issue that's been longstanding, but an issue that has come to kind of greater prominence right now?
Well, it's a great question. And I'd actually say that even we in California, I mean, I think we've done a lot of interesting progressive organizing. We'll get to a little bit of what the shortcomings are, et cetera. Mm. And I hope we get to talk a little bit about the history and the roots of where it came from. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's also a pretty interesting sort of phenomena that's gone on right now in terms of social movements around the country, particularly youth-led movements. You know, it's important to realize that the Dreamers, that was a youth-led movement, which decided to sort of capture the American narrative of the dream and talk about how undocumented folks who came at an early age, who grew up here, had every right to aspire to that dream. And could you have predicted that a ragtag group of undocumented kids would actually change the discussion around immigration in the country? Incredible. You know, if you look at Black Lives Matter, a lot of that came out of youth organizing. And interestingly, Black Lives Matter is a value statement, right? It's not a policy objective. It's a value statement, mm-hmm. which has a lot of policy objectives and campaigns attached to it. Mm-hmm. If you look at the Standing Rock movement, mm-hmm. Which captured people's imagination, I don't know how many people know that actually came from a bunch of young Native Americans who wanted to tackle the whole question of suicide on the reservation and wanted to kind of recapture the sort of spiritualism, and part of that was the connection to the earth, and part of that's what led to the Standing Rock movement. Mm-hmm. And then perhaps most interestingly in the last year, and I think gets directly to what's going on right now, is the Parkland youth and what they did after the mass shooting that occurred there. A couple things about it. You know, they immediately called to people's values, and they have made more progress against the National Rifle Association than decades of organizing by traditional political forces have. The other thing they did, which I think is remarkable and I think speaks to what you really lifted up in a minute, you know, as the Parkland kids began speaking and organizing the March for Our Lives in D.C., they were criticized fairly quickly by folks from South Los Angeles, Chicago, and Baltimore, said, we've been living with gun violence for years. We really feel your pain, but we've been living with gun violence for years. Interestingly, my friend Marquise Harris-Dawson, who's on the LA City Council, at a meeting said, you know, if it had been people of an older generation, they would have reacted like, oh my God, we're being criticized, and they would have, you know, had to go to therapy for a very long time and, you know, have a self-help group and go to the Blue Shield Foundation and ask for money for a conference to discuss all of this. you know, instead the Parkland kids went, you know, you're right. We should change our agenda to include that, too. And they brought folks from Chicago and Baltimore and South L.A. to speak at March for Our Lives. In the summer, they've been going around to all sorts of communities raising the whole issues of gun violence. They have perfected both the people, because I know them, who laid the critiques and the people who responded, the Parkland youth. They've perfected the act of calling in versus calling out. Mm. That is, making a criticism that's meant to build a bigger movement rather than making a criticism that's meant to divide us into the smallest possible particles that are politically correct but politically ineffective. Mm. And so I think around the sort of Me Too movement, around violence against young women and girls, I think that one of the things that's been very helpful about you know, you might make individual criticism, but most of it's been about calling in versus calling out. Mm. Most of it's about getting empowering women to speak and getting men to recognize the power that they wield and the ways in which that's unhealthy for society, including for men themselves. So I'm quite optimistic about how that movement is operating as well.
Mm-hmm. I love how you shared that piece about kind of calling in versus calling out. Kind of one quick follow-up on that piece is when people think about gender equity, and I did some work with the mayor's office in San Francisco related to gender equity, I know there's a lot of talk about kind of the intersectional piece, and I'm just curious if there are any kind of thoughts about what that looks like as it fits into kind of the Me Too movement or things like that.
Well, thank you for asking that question, only because this book has taken off more than any other. Most academic books I write are quite good, but they get quite small audiences. This one is about to be made into a major motion picture in which I'm going to be portrayed by Antonio Banderas, so I'm really excited. That's not really happening. But it's interesting. One of the things that really helped the book take off was that got a really favorable review in the New York Times review of books, front page cover. And the one criticism that the reviewer had was, he keeps talking about intersectionality. And I thought, this is great. The young people are going to really love this as a critique, right? So intersectionality is kind of understanding that not all of our lives are not sort of a single identity as Latino or male or cisgendered, or, you know, that there's many different multiple identities that form who we are. And that also it means that we sort of need to understand each other's multiple identities and the movements we build that are themselves intersectional, that are calling for justice for immigrants because it's about human dignity, that sort of understand that we are not going to get sort of immigrant rights unless we've dealt with the over-incarceration crisis and the sort of permanent othering of African Americans in U.S. society and sort of leaving behind, unless we deal with those cleavages, we're not going to move ahead together. I think that's been really fundamental and foundational to movement building in California. You know, one story we talk about in the book is that when President Obama won, Californians in their glory also passed Prop 8, right, which was eliminating the right of couples, same-sex couples, to marry. And the LGBTQ movement could have reacted to that, particularly to some of the early data, which was partially wrong, that African Americans and Latinos had, you know, voted more in favor of that than even non-Hispanic whites. They could have reacted like, oh, this, you know, those are uncertain allies. And instead, a lot of the reaction was, gosh, we haven't really been there for immigrant rights struggles. And so we can't really expect immigrants to step in if we haven't been there for other people's struggles. Mm. And a lot of the folks in the LGBTQ movement organized this thing called Camp Courage, which brought people together to talk, yes, about marriage equality, but how it was connected to the way in which working class people were being left behind in an economy that no longer functioned, how folks who were over-incarcerated were being left behind and then permanently damaged by that in their ability to move ahead in labor markets, how immigrants were being left behind. And there's a great quote in there about Tori Osborne, who was one of the organizers of this, giving a speech at the end saying, "You think you came here for marriage equality? We tricked you. We actually brought you so that you could figure out how to stand in solidarity with everybody else's struggle, because that's how we're going to win marriage equality." Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of that happened with regard to, for example, the labor movement, realizing that they would only get ahead if they worked with immigrants realizing that however important the Catholic Church is to immigrants and to the funding of the immigrant rights movement, that people had to stand and oppose any kinds of attacks on LGBTQ folks and stand up for marriage equality. That sort of coming together is really important. Mm. There's two quote musical citations in the book. I'll talk about one at the end, but one that may appeal to an older audience is we brought in Bob Dylan. That great song, My Back Pages, where he says, I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. And I think that a lot of people who are older got very used to siloed struggles. And a lot of people who are younger are not used to siloed experiences or siloed struggles. And I think many of us have to be younger than that now and be much more intersectional in our politics.
Yeah, I love that. Younger than that now.
At my age, it feels very good to say that, yes.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
I just had a birthday, and my my husband's birthday was yesterday. So ours are back to back, and I told him that I was going to redo 38, even though I'm 42, all in an effort to get on one of those lists. I want to be one of those 40 under 40, because I never hear about 50 under 50. Where are the 60s under 60s? 70 people doing great things under 70. But you mentioned this piece about the music, and I wanted to speak about the music because I love the musical references, and I'm just curious how you, can you tell us a little bit about them, and can you tell us how you chose the songs that you did?
Sure, and I didn't choose all the songs I wanted. So I talked about my dad. My mom was a singer and a mandolin player because my grandfather was actually the leader of a little Spanish language band. They were quite the hit. He grew up, she grew up in Harlem, and he was a musician in Harlem who was actually a numbers runner. That's how he made money. those of you who are young don't know what this is, but those who are old know what this was criminal activity. But it fed my family. So there's a kind of musical strain in the family. And I've been always quite moved by the way in which music and musicians tell us the story of our times. So, you know, for example, someone who I didn't quote, but I quote all the time is Kendrick Lamar. because those of you who know have, for example, the album Good Kid, Mad City, where he talks about being a good kid in a city gone crazy, which is about growing up in Los Angeles. He was growing up in Compton and being caught between the red and the blue, being caught between the Bloods and the Crips at the time, but also being caught between the red and the blue of the police force. Mm. So what does it mean to be a good kid trying to stay out of gangs and also not be kind of tackled by the police? So I just love music. I was one of the few people who predicted that Kendrick would win the Pulitzer Prize. and was delighted when he did. But the other reference in the book is to someone who I think really paved the way for Kendrick in an entire era of hip hop, and that's Gil Scott-Heron. Mm-hmm. Because Gil Scott-Heron was doing spoken word and music long before anyone else. Mm. And there are many good songs, but the one that we quoted in the book is Ain't No Such Thing as a Superman. And the reason for it is the following. The song goes, you alone have the wisdom to change the world, to make the world what it want to be, what it ought to be. Someday you'll see, once you understand that there ain't no such thing as a Superman. Mm. And the point of putting that in the book at that point is that I think that we in the United States tend to think that the world changes through a Superman, that a single individual is responsible for making change, that somehow President Obama was going to save us from ourselves, and that somehow if we got rid of Donald Trump, we would get rid of the toxic anxieties that gave us Donald Trump. Mm. But there ain't no such thing as a Superman. There's only us. Mm. And in fact, one of the things that really prompted this book originally was a Newsweek cover, which we actually talk about in the book, which was a cover, had a picture of Jerry Brown, and it said Altered State. This is as California is making its comeback. Yeah, Altered State, which is sort of a reference to how hallucinatory we are. But then it also, the subtext was how Jerry Brown saved California. And that's a story a lot of people like to hear, like Jerry Brown. You know, he was around for the first era. Prop 13 happened under his watch. It was kind of a disaster for the state. He left. He visited with Mother Teresa. He gained some wisdom. He came back through mayor of Oakland and attorney general, and now he saves the state. It's an easy story, and it's a wrong story. You know, the fiscal remedy to our big budget problems that Jerry Brown claims credit for, Prop 30, and he did work for it. It actually wasn't his idea. He wanted to pass a bill that was mostly an increase in the sales tax and very light on the income tax. It was pretty regressive. But instead, there was a group of organizers under the banner of California Calls that were pushing for a millionaire's tax, and Brown realized that pulled much better than his tax, and he had to wind up negotiating with people who were like the former, you know, Black Panther Party members to engage in a bill that actually passed. The minimum wage, which he takes credit for, the way that it came together was he was trying to head off at the pass a minimum wage fight that was actually pushing for a much more aggressive increase in the minimum wage that would have been quicker with no off-ramps for small businesses or nonprofits and none of the stabilizers that are built in there in case the state wanders into recession or a fiscal deficit, which Brown insisted on. Similarly, you know, Jerry Brown wasn't like he woke up one day and said, gosh, I want licenses for undocumented drivers. The political momentum had shifted such that it was possible for that to happen. And the sanctuary state bill that Kevin DeLeon wound up pushing through and Brown sort of moderated was all due to community organizers who changed the underlying political calculus. You know, during the Obama administration, a lot of people would point a finger at Obama and said, we don't have comprehensive immigration reform yet. And they wanted to blame Obama. And I said, you know, why don't you just look in a mirror? We have not changed the political calculus on the ground that makes it politically viable for Obama to lean out on this. Could he have had more courage? Yes. Had we changed the underlying calculus? No. So a lot of what the book, and particularly that song, you know, there ain't no such thing as a Superman. If you want the world to change, look around you. It's in this room. It's you who can actually change the world.
Yeah. Well, right? Am I right? Can we talk a little bit about othering? Let's go to the othering. Even at a very base level, it seems like people have a lot of difficulty thinking about anyone who is not their sister, child, spouse, you know, best friend. And I'm curious what you think are kind of some of our opportunities to get people to a place of at least some semblance of shared fate. Be brutally honest with us. Do you think that is possible to get people to some semblance of shared fate and not just thinking about the things that are the direct connections to them and theirs?
So that's a great question. And I'm going to do the academic thing, which is I will have eventually answer that question, but I'm going to answer a question that I'm going to pretend you asked. but I think it's a way to get there, because I think one thing that's kind of important in the book is that we actually start the story, the history, by asking the question, when did California work? Mm. And we start in chapter 2. I remember this because I wrote it. with an editorial that appeared in the Los Angeles Times some time ago, and it was by David Hayes Bautista from UCLA, and the editorial was, you know, I don't know what we're going to do with a population that's recently arrived, poorly educated, has too many kids, lives in overcrowded housing. And then he pointed out that, of course, we're talking about the Okies that arrived in California in the 40s and 50s, and somehow we figured out how to integrate them. So what we do in the book is start in the 40s and 50s and 60s, the era in which my parents arrived in California. And it is an era in which there were lots of impediments, racial segregation in housing and racial segregation in labor markets, and many of us fighting to break our way in. But it was also a time in which people were moving here, thinking it was a chance for opportunity. And the reason why was that we were investing in infrastructure, roads and water. We were building housing, suburbia. which many of us feel like was a big mistake, and we're changing it now. But we were also investing in human capital. We had an expanding K through 12 system, and we had the master plan, which was an agreement to invest in and articulate these three systems: the University of California, State University system, the community college system. It was all kind of tied together with an economy that was growing jobs in the middle, and it was actually held together by a social compact that was about both welcoming the newcomer. This was a time in which people were coming from all sorts of other states to come to the United States and investing in the next generation. Mm-hmm. And the argument of the book, and this does actually get to your question, I'm sneaking in, which the argument of the book is that basically that eroded because of race and racism. As early as the early 1960s, people were reacting to the slowly changing demography. For example, in 1963, the state Senate and Assembly passed a law outlawing racial discrimination in housing. And in 1964, Prop 14 was put on the ballot, which was a ballot and a measure in which California voters voted to reinstitute segregation in housing in the name of your own private property, and you could do with it and sell it to who you wanted. The person who rode that campaign to the governorship was Ronald Reagan. And, you know, long before the racial propositions, there was Prop 13. And if you think about Prop 13, it passes in the 1970s, late 1970s, in the decade in which the share of children who were children of color rises the most of any time in California history before or since. And what did Prop 13 do? It's basically a declaration of generational warfare. Mm. It says if you're older and you have property, your tax assessments are going to loop back to historic values, and they can only increase by 1% a year. But if you're a younger and more diverse generation buying into the housing market, you're going to pay full freight. And it's going to starve the state, so we're not going to be able to invest in your kids anyway. And just like the Trump tax cuts that recently passed, it turned out to be a Trojan horse for reducing taxes on corporations, because they're the ones who don't change property all that much, and it wound up shifting the tax burden from corporate commercial and industrial property to residential property. And that sort of racial undertones of Prop 13 fed into the racial propositions of the early 1990s. Mm. So a big argument about in the book is the following, that we had a social compact and a non-othering, that it got kind of eroded by race and racism, and that the argument that emerged after the Trump victory, you'll remember this in Democratic Party circles, is it about class or is it about race? Which the only way you can sort of think that you have to either or that is if you think that Americans cannot hold two ideas in their head at the same time. Yes, it's about class and it's about race. And most importantly, race and racism led us to be distracted from focusing in on the economic restructuring, the deindustrialization and the job loss, the disappearance of the middle that was going on in the 1990s. It was easier to blame an immigrant for simultaneously taking your job and being on welfare. How that's possible, I'm not sure, but to blame the other rather than to come to a solution. And the reason why this is important is the way that we get past this. Some people want to say that we'll get past this by focusing in just on common ground issues like the economy, etc. We have to talk about race and racism, the way in which it's created a legacy that is toxic in terms of people's attitudes and in terms of current policies, the way in which it's disadvantaged people in the current era, and the way in which it lives today in terms of our policies. And unless we have that honest conversation about race, we're not going to find our way to the common ground that will help us deal with what we do have in common, which is a social compact about investing in the next generation and creating an economy that works for everyone.
Fantastic. It's interesting because I was about to ask you about this piece of honestly engaging in racial anxiety as you speak to, and you just answered it. So thank you so much for doing that. I'm curious if there's anything you would add to that. Like, what does it look like for us to honestly engage? I felt like what you said was one of the kind of key ways to do that. Is there anything else that you think is a key way to honestly engage in racial anxiety?
Well, I would say, you know, a couple of things. The biggest thing is to not ignore it. Mm. You know, the last book I wrote that actually sold a lot of copies was Uncommon Common Ground. Mm. It was called Uncommon Common Ground, Race in the American Future. And it was written with Angela Glover Blackwell, who heads Policy Link, and Stuart Kuo, who heads Asian Americans Advancing Justice. And I know when we sat down to write the book about race in America, a lot of people said, well, that's really interesting. It's an African-American, a Latino, and an Asian. And we said, you know what's really interesting? We're all Californians. You know, but we actually sat down, even as we had known each other for years, and had like several days of just talking with each other about, you know, why is Jim Crow and slavery actually so important in terms of thinking about today for Asian Americans, some of whom are doing well economically? Mm-hmm. What really is the experience of race? I mean, we're actually see it in terms of the permanent othering of Asian Americans, the fact that it's 25 years before we have another film with a nearly all Asian cast. Mm-hmm. Rich Crazy Asians is coming out this week. Please support it. Or, you know, people going, Latinos, you know, are you Latinos? Are you Chicanos? Are you Hispanos? Are you Latinx? Can't you figure out what to call yourself? But part of that is sort of a people coming into its own and figuring out what to name itself. Mm-hmm. So we had a lot of those conversations. And you'll notice that through this conversation and through most of my talks, I talk a lot about race. Part of it because I think it's really important. Part of it because I want you to talk about race and mm-hmm. want you to feel comfortable making mistakes with one another mm-hmm. as you talk about race. I want to call you in versus calling you out. And because I want you to understand that if you're talking about the economy, you're talking about racial disparity. How many of you care about climate change in this audience? Quite a few. How many of you know that if you look at public policy polls for the last polling for the last about 10 years running, the group that cares the most about climate change is not who you think. Most people think it's white people, like a white guy in bicycle shorts, right? Kind of throwing granola over his shoulder, saying the climate, it's really important, right? If you poll in order of who says they care the most about climate and think it's a big danger to the quality of life and the economy of California, the group that polls the lowest is whites. The group that polls with the most next most concern, African Americans. Mm. Next, it's Asian. The group that's the most concerned are Latinos. Why? Because they're experiencing the highest risk from climate change, and because a lot of climate change, which gets associated with pollution, is highest in these neighborhoods. So if you want to do something about climate, you better think about race, not only because of the disparate impacts, but of how you're going to mobilize folks mm-hmm. as well. So I think the really big thing is you don't kind of get past this othering right. unless you really talk with people about these issues. The final thing I would say about this, you've gotten me excited.
Yay.
is the following thing. I've done historically a lot of work in particular with the black-brown work, bringing together African-Americans and Latinos. And to me, what I've discovered about that is that you don't get immigrants to care about African-American issues by saying, look, these folks care about these things. We need to build some alliances. Let's do some transactions. Mm. You do it by educating people about the history of the United States, how the fundamental cleavages have been that of the genocide of Native Americans and the enslavement of African Americans, and that unless we solve those fundamental deep problems of racism built in, no immigrants are going to be able to advance. Plus, you really wouldn't want to be part of an immigrant group hopscotching over mm-hmm. the most oppressed people in America. And if you root that really deeply, then the way in which immigrants are going to forge alliances with African Americans is going to be real and authentic and transformational, not transactional.
Right.
Similarly, for African Americans, I always say, look, if you want to understand immigrants and be sympathetic to immigrants, read The Warmth of Other Suns by Isabel Dickerson. It's all about the Great Migration. And that when people moved to places like California, you know, there were too many people in a house and they had too many cars in their front yard too. And when you understand that experience, and she is beautiful in that book about Isabel Wilkerson, about always going back and saying about every 50 pages, doesn't that sound like immigrants today, making the explicit connection? Then the way in which you build alliances is real and authentic and transformational, not translational. Not transactional.
Fantastic. For my very last question, I'm actually just going to ask you if you would read a small selection from your book. And just so that folks know, I put the little post-it there for you. The last page, fear not, it doesn't ruin the story for him to read the last page. We still know we won't know who done it. So if you would be so kind.
Okay, so this is quite typical of book events is to actually read the book. It's actually the last couple pages, and it starts with my graduation from UC Santa Cruz, in which, because it was UC Santa Cruz, it was 1978, couple things happened. One is that none of us wore gowns. Two is that even though I was asked to be the class speaker, we refused to let honors or the class speaker name be published in the thing because we thought that was too individualistic. and the way that I gave my speech was that first we did guerrilla theater and then I emerged to give the speech. and it was actually... you'll see. I spent my scant few minutes not honoring my parents, although in retrospect I should have. Sorry, Mom and Dad, and that's one of the reasons this book is dedicated to you. Instead, I pined at length about how I thought Prop 13, which had just passed week before, was likely to shipwreck the state. Because I realized then, as I do even more viscerally now, that what made the California dream possible was not just the energy of those who had arrived, but the infrastructure Californians inherited. The state had taken on the big challenges of energy, water, and housing. It had focused on generating an economy that could produce both enormous wealth and a large middle class. And it had expanded education in a way that made it possible for people like me to succeed. Many of us had to fight our way in, battles around university admission, public school spending, and access to jobs and housing were part and parcel of a struggle against the racial restrictions that limited the reach of opportunity. But the state's philosophic footing, what moored the state itself, was the idea that a social compact could and should connect generations and geographies, ethnicities and economic classes in a common destiny. What America needs more of now is that California dream and the compact that drove it. It embodied and supported a willingness to invest in those who were here and to welcome those who were soon to arrive, exactly the logic behind a comprehensive immigration reform aimed at legalizing the undocumented and setting up migration flows for the future. It was reflected in a commitment to housing, education, and job growth, clearly direct prerequisites for working with communities, business, and the public sector to develop an economy that can work for all. It offered a chance for people to come, remake themselves, and rebuild their lives, certainly what we need to do now to shrink our prison population and create path to successful reentry. To perfect this dream and to defend its future, California has declared itself a state of resistance. Lawsuits will be filed against an overreaching and reactionary Washington. Political figures will speak out for the state's progressive achievements, and movement organizers will try to hold the state's policymakers honest to their supposed social justice ambitions. The state is big and powerful. With the world's sixth largest, now fifth largest, economy, it will have the resources and, quite frankly, the will to respond to threats and to further its agenda. But resistance cannot come from just one state, and it cannot be targeted at just one politician. After all, Donald Trump may represent a sort of apogee of right-wing and personal opportunism, but he is reflective of an era in which division, difference, and deception have become the calling cards of modern political discourse, that he secured the support of many, indeed of any, is a testimony to the cleavages in the country and the craven willingness of a political party to support anyone who could win. The fight ahead is not about eliminating the influence of one leader, but about ridding the nation of the toxic anxiety that once gave us Prop 187 and is now bestowed upon us a destructive presidency. So how do we avoid a repetition of California's once fall from grace? How do we learn to turn to one another rather than away, to engage civically rather than withdraw in cynicism, to embrace what's new rather than cling to what's old? That is the challenge facing America, and the real measure of the state of resistance will be how we address it as a nation. Ultimately, the country's political health will not be improved by cable news spats, but rather by organizing communities, lobbying policymakers, and persuading new leaders to run for public office. Achieving change will require purpose and passion, but also patience. So dig in for what one hopes will be a resurgence from America's own dizzying descent, and let us work together to resist, recover, and rebuild a more prosperous, inclusive, and sustainable America.
I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that they're listening to Professor Manuel Pastor speaking about his book, State of Resistance. He just was interviewed by Autumn McDonald from New America Corp, California. And it's time for Q&A. And if anybody has any questions, you can raise your hand. I got some cards already, so I will ask the first question this way.
Thank you. I'm reminded of a song we used to sing in the 70s and 80s. Besieged by similar problems, without offending all of you by singing this, the keywords were teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs. It's all their fault. This was a parody, folks. We didn't mean it. This was kind of pointing out what was going on during the era of state-based austerity at that point. What frustrates me a bit is that you give us such a clear picture, both in the stories of your family and the policies and politics you talk about, of these broader economic and political changes that have happened: globalization, austerity, job losses, privatization, all that stuff. You know that, and you talk about it, but you are posing that. You're saying that the core work that we need to do is to cross racial and ethnic and community lines. And I feel like that's the discussion that we're having nationally and locally about those trends. I mean, clearly, those are what are dividing us as a nation politically, you know. Mm-hmm. But I feel like we're sort of, it can't be either or. You know, we need to be for intersectionality across cultural lines, as you've described very clearly. And we also need to focus on these policy differences. And I'm just wondering how you kind of stitch that together and if you can help the rest of us do that.
What a great question, and I look forward to your book. but so I don't want to leave you with that more simple impression of what I'm saying. I think what we try to do in the book is to lay out the argument that California, the change in California, we could talk about the imperfections in California too, and we should, is that due to a series of structural changes, some of them economic, some of them demographic. I mean, the state changed demographically. That brought out new voters. But it also meant that people began to realize that, you know, demographic change is going to bring Korean taco trucks, and that's probably a good thing. And there were political rules that changed as well. I mean, I think that term limits, which people thought was going to be a challenge. There's no way that Karen Bass, a community organizer from South LA, would have become the first African-American female leader of a state assembly in this state or any other state unless there had been term limits. There's no way Kevin De Leon, who cut his teeth organizing on Prop 187, would have become president pro tem of the Senate and eventually passed the sanctuary state bill and also a bill to make sure that the proceeds from cap and trade go to less advantaged communities without term limits. But there's a whole chapter in the book that's pretty unromantically about power building, because it's not just about reaching out and being nice to people and having dialogues. It's about having sufficient power so that people cannot impose their unjust will on other people. And that, I think, is really important. My friend Angela Glover Blackwell, I was asked, she's stepping down from PolicyLink, and people were asked to contribute quotes that were your favorite quote. And anybody who knows Angela Glover Blackwell, she's such an eloquent speaker, and she says so many beautiful things. And I think everybody was searching for the right thing to say. But the only thing that jumped to my mind was that one time she told me, you know what? We never changed Bull Connors' mind. Bull Connors was the famous head of the law enforcement in Birmingham who turned water hoses on young kids protesting Jim Crow. He just got marginalized, so he could not exercise his point of view on other people. So you need to build as big a, you know, you want to build a big tent, but you don't want it to be a circus. and it needs to be strategic about building sufficient power. So really what it's about is how those intersectionalities worked to build new and unexpected ties. I mean, you know, it's not as though, you know, when the minimum wage went up in the state of California, the California Chamber of Commerce was not consulted because nobody needed to talk to them because their opinion really didn't count anyway. It was going to pass. When you think about, there was some moderation, but not a lot of moderation on the sanctuary state legislation. That has to do with the way in which immigrants have asserted their ability to influence the polity. Mm-hmm. So you need to build power and you need to build allies.
Mm-hmm.
Next question. Okay. Here's one. How can policies that stimulated California's resurgence be applied to the whole nation given the difference in demographics? Mm-hmm. There's another question fairly similar that says, and without creating a kind of California exceptionalism attitude, because California's seen that way outside of the state.
So a couple of things, particularly when I'm out of state, I do tell people that, you know, two things about California. One is that I know you don't like it when we say that we're your future, but we are. And there are some lessons to pull out. And I do think that there's some general lessons that are really kind of percolating through the nation right now. One is, you know, if you look at something that we call the racial generation gap, the percent of people above the age of 65 compared to the percent of people under the age of 18 or kids of color, that actually peaked in California in 1994 to 1998 during all those propositions, the demographic distance between the generations. Mm-hmm. Do you know when it's peaking in the United States, right? It's right now, the year in which Trump was elected. So one thing is to make sure that we have a generational strategy as well as part of our organizing strategy. Another really clear thing is to be clear in other states about this idea of building power and effective power that sort of operates at a local scale, built up to a city and regional scale, and then built up to state scale. That's a lot of what got lost during the Obama period with the bum rush. The other really key thing, and then I'll loop back to California for a minute, is to sort of understand that it's about two things. One is it's about moving to the middle, not moving to the middle. Mm. It's not about trying to find a centrist position. It's trying to find those spots that bring the center your way. So the Dreamers campaign brought a lot of people to immigrant rights. The women's marches have brought a lot of people over. The Me Too movement, I think, does that as well. The other thing is that it's not about chasing the electorate. How many times have you heard Bundens talk about if we just got one of those white Trump voters to come our way? Good effing luck with that. It's about changing the electorate. It's about mobilizing people who have never come out in elections. And we're seeing that in the midterms right now, that you're seeing a sort of new electorate being mobilized in many unexpected places. And it's going to look different in Pennsylvania. But, I mean, who would have thought Beto O'Rourke would have captured so much attention against Ted Cruz? He's mobilizing a new set of voters. Now, one thing to really keep in mind, and this is both where California exceptionalism should be put to one side and where the audience, those of you who don't speak Spanish, get to learn something concrete, a Spanish word or phrase. And that Spanish phrase is se cree muy muy. The Spanish speakers know what that means. It literally means he believes himself to be very, very, he's conceited. California se cree muy muy, right? California is very conceited. We're like, oh my gosh, you know, we're dealing with the climate and we're cool to immigrants and we've raised the minimum wage and we're starting to de-incarcerate. We're really cool. We are the fourth most unequal state in the United States in terms of income distribution. The household income gaps between whites and African Americans and Latinos is basically where it was in the early 1990s. We have de-incarcerated or begun that process, but we don't have reentry programs at scale that are sufficient. We are not cooperating with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, but we haven't reworked our workforce development programs to make sure that undocumented immigrants can find a way to learning English and doing better in the labor force. So we've got a lot of work. And what we call for in the book is that California needs to defend, develop, and deploy. We need to defend ourselves against an overreaching federal government. We need to push the policy envelope further on policies that will make a difference for communities here. And we need to deploy our troops to help other states make a change.
Thank you very much. That we had time almost for one more question, but you just answered it. And it was about what programs, but we are out of time now.
Okay.
So thank you very, very much for a great discussion. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 116th year of enlightened discussion.